It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's class warfare in the California wine country. Napa and Sonoma, two very different places, yet both mirror the new homogenizing of rural America. Our guest is Alan Deutschman, author of A Tale of Two Valleys, Wine, Wealth, and the Battle for the Good Life in Napa and Sonoma. Away from the fray are the Sterns. They're eating Jesus crab and flounder on the South Carolina coast. Cracker Jack cook Sally Schneider transports fresh soybeans across the pond. Then it's a new world of veggies, literally. We're talking greens from the ocean deep. And we have the backstory of Morocco's rare and luscious argan oil. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be you me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid love me, best way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, and never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry, peel me a grape. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug
of me knew with thunder burden me. You heard me, I am getting hungry.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's class warfare in Napa and Sonoma, gentrification versus local culture, complicated by the grapevine. Our guest is Alan Deutschman. His book is A Tale of Two Valleys, Wine, Wealth, and the Battle for the Good Life in Napa and Sonoma. Expert cook Sally Schneider takes on fresh soybeans. Then it's a new realm of veggies. We are one of the few cultures in the world that ignores greens from the sea. We've got a how-to guide. More new stuff, an oil coming out of Morocco that smells and tastes of roasted nuts. It's argan oil. We have the scoop. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. Okay, so you two, where have you been?
We were twisting and turning down at the fringes of the end of South Carolina on John's Island, South Carolina. And we came across this fabulous seafood market that fries or cooks the seafood there so you can eat it. What tickled us no end about this restaurant, aside from the fact that it was just great food, was they had a twist on the regional specialty of devil crab there. This is a very religious owner, the man who runs the seafood restaurant. So instead of calling it devil crab, he calls it Jesus crab. So you go in and you ask for an order of Jesus crab, and then you wait and eat this positively delicious thing.
I'm not going where I was about to go. What is it? But what is it exactly?
It's a devil crab. It's just.
But it's just too good to be called devil crab. That's the way he explained it to us.
Right. It's sinfully delicious, but he does not want the word devil in his market. So whether he calls it devil crab or angel crab or Jesus crab or whatever, it is still first-rate South Carolinian crab in a ramekin of shell with breadcrumbs and fresh-picked crab meat. A little cayenne pepper.
A lot of
cayenne pepper, powdered mustard, a little mayo, and, call it what you will, it is first rate.
Now, Jane is the crab eater among us. I personally much prefer the flounder sandwich. I mean, you walk in, you pick out the piece of flounder from their case that you want them to fry. They bread it, they fry it, and they put it between two pieces of bread. Now, if you've eaten flounder along the coast there, you realize that a fillet of flounder is generally about six times the size of a slice of white bread. So this is such a ridiculous-looking sandwich, impossible to pick up. But the flounder is so delicious. I mean, it's flatfish like I have never eaten flatfish.
So what is this place called?
It's called Fishnet Seafood. It's actually a former gas station. And we should say there is no place to eat there whatsoever except sitting in your car out in the parking lot. Many people buy this to take home. Mm-hmm. It's to call it casual is not really the correct word. It's It's totally off the cuff. I mean, you walk in, you look at the raw seafood on display, and you ask them to cook whatever you want.
Well, it's
and
very,
they will.
It's very workmanlike. I mean, it's not fancy. In fact, there are a lot of working men there getting their lunches to go. My favorite thing, actually, was a combo plate, which was freshly fried shrimp. Again, they just take the shrimp right out of the display, shell them, deep fry them, and that comes with a side of Jesus crab and sweetened iced tea. And it is, you know, I mean, it is, what can I say, heavenly? I mean, how, you know, how cliche does that, but it
so
is.
Other than the Jesus crab, is your choice in terms of cooking, you can have it fried or you can have it fried?
Basically, yes. You know, but you have to understand, this is South Carolina, and I know you've talked to John Martin Taylor enough to know that frying in this part of the world is an art. I mean, this is elegantly fried seafood. To call it tempura isn't right, but it's got that fine, fragile, brittle, savory crust that is a mile away from that doughy fried seafood that we expect in other parts of the country.
Or that big, you know, breadcrumb-ridden stuff that where the breading falls off and leaves this little naked, shivering shrimp.
I have to say, this is the only place in my life where I have ever consistently eaten fried food and lost weight.
I believe it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's incredible. Okay, so
there's an idea for a diet book.
The Carolina fried seafood diet.
Oh, I'm with you on that one, Liz.
I'll sign up, too.
Okay, so it's the fishnet shop, and we have to
fishnet
eat
seafood.
And we're going to have flounder all over the car.
Yep.
Thank God it's a rental.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Liz.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Road Food. Now, you hear the Sterns here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting the website, don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Each week you get a new recipe for a quick supper dish, tips on techniques, shopping info, and all you have to do is sign up. It costs not a penny. At the website, splendidtable.org. Food writer Sally Schneider is the author of A New Way to Cook. Now, Sally streamlines dishes. She makes them healthier. But the thing that she does that's really uncanny to me is she usually makes them taste better. And that shows you that she's a great cook. Sally, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Lynn.
So what have you been working on? What's the latest?
Well, what's been happening, it's been brewing for a couple of years now. Fresh green soybeans have been appearing in the farmers' markets in their pod. These are the soybeans that you would find as a sort of esoteric hors d'oeuvre to drink, eat with sake in Japanese restaurants. But now they're becoming ubiquitous. Now, these are not the old yellow soybeans that I used to try to cook for 5 hours and never made them tender in the 70s. These are actually fresh green shell beans like limas or peas or the fabulous fava bean.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought them originally to cook them like they do in Japanese restaurants. You boil them for about 3 to 5 minutes in the pod and then salt them. And then as you peel them hot, the salt that sticks to your fingers seasons the beans. And you eat them as an hors d'oeuvre, and it's totally charming and wonderful. But then I thought, wait a minute, these are pod beans. So why don't I treat them like favas, which I never have time to make? And I I shucked some and cooked them and drizzled them with extra virgin olive oil and shaved some pecorino, some aged sheep's milk cheese on them, as they do in Italy. And I had a fabulous Italian dish.
With soybeans.
With soybeans. So what I've been doing, Lynn, is treating them as though they're a European bean rather than an Asian one, because they take so well to flavors as they do in Europe.
What I wonder is, if we can't get them fresh, can you do all of this with those frozen beans?
They're just as good. You can get them frozen in the pod, and you can get them shelled. What I look out for, though, with the frozen ones is that they say non-GMO. That means not genetically modified soybean seeds. And because there's a lot of controversy about that, and as long as there's controversy, I don't want anything to do with it. So I either use those, or when in summer, when they're in the markets, I buy them. I look for nice green pods. Sometimes they're kind of furry and tinged with a little bit of yellow, but you'll see that they kind of have a vibrancy to them, and you'll see the shape of the bean through the pod, which means you have nice fat beans.
Is smaller better in this case?
I would say yes, because the bigger they are, the older they are, the more their starches develop, and you have less of that kind of sweet, succulent, pea-like flavor.
So give me some more recipe ideas.
Well, first of all, let's just consider them in the shell, because you can get them that way. So I highly recommend that Japanese method. You can also toss them with olive oil and roast them in a 350-degree oven for about 5 minutes. And I've also sandwiched them in one of those grill baskets and put them on the grill.
In the shell?
In the shell.
Great
and
idea.
As a sort of hors d'oeuvre before, you know, the grilling meal, when we're all sitting outside. And I dump them into a basket with some coarse salt or sea salt, and we eat them out of hand like that, shelling them and as we go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to use them outside of the pod, think of them as being like peas, for example, or lima beans. They love pork products. I especially love to braise them with pancetta. They have affinities for leeks. They love asparagus and string beans and artichokes. I often make braises and medleys using soybeans, as I used to use fava beans. Best of all, perhaps, is a succotash. Now, that's a real American dish, usually made with corn and lima beans. I do it with soybeans, fresh corn cut off the cob, and bacon. I'll render the bacon till it's crisp, and then just throw the soybeans in to cook them slightly. Then the corn, which only needs a minute or two of cooking.
So this is all really fast, then.
That is exactly the beauty of it, Lynn. It's fast, it's fresh, it is unbelievably healthful. Soybeans are known for their high amount of protein, which is also a complete protein, unlike other vegetable sources. So it has all the amino acids. It's balanced in its carbohydrates. It has hardly any fat. They're very satisfying. And so these are what I use in my busy life when I really want something that's got kind of the effect of a great shell bean, but I don't have the time.
Okay, Sally, I'm on the lookout for soybeans. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can get her recipe for that succotash on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, the other bean that's going nuts right now is the green bean and its sibling, the yellow wax bean. They're great for snacking as a starter. I'm not kidding. I mean, you just drop them in boiling salted water, cook them until they're tender, drain them, and just serve them up. Eat them with your hands. Of course, you could toss the beans with my new hot and sour spiking sauce. Now, this is another goodie that comes straight from this farmer's market. It's sort of a homemade Tabasco. You buy up a bunch of fresh chilies. Go for an interesting mix, maybe cayenne, mirasol, jalapeno, but no habaneros. Those are the super hot ones. They're going to blast you out of the kitchen. Now, wearing plastic gloves, you cut them up, seeds and all, into a blender, add some salt, cider vinegar to cover, and your puree. And then you just put it in a glass jar and you can keep it in the fridge up to a week. Now, toss some of this with green beans, sprinkle it over sandwiches, or rub it into fish before it hits the grill. Coming up, the battle for the good life in Napa and Sonoma, ocean veggies, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where you can have your cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. We are off to wine and food wonderland. Now, I'm talking about Northern California, the glamorous, think Tuscany under glass, Napa Valley, and its bohemian, ragtag, but nonetheless enticing neighbor, the Sonoma Valley. Journalist Alan Deutschman says the two valleys are portraits of the new class warfare that's being played out all over the United States. His latest book is called A Tale of Two Valleys, Wine, Wealth, and the Battle for the Good Life in Napa and Sonoma. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
So we say Napa-Sonoma in one breath. I mean, we think of them as there's wine, there's great restaurants, wonderful place to visit. But you say they're completely different places. So can you explain what the differences are?
Well, the Napa and Sonoma Valleys are right next door to each other, but they have different personalities. Napa is very much about status and prestige and conspicuous consumption. It's the place that has reputedly the best restaurants in America, the French Laundry, but you can't get a reservation there. It has the most famous and acclaimed wines, but the cult wines, but you can't even buy them in stores. Napa is about exclusivity and denial, whereas Sonoma is more of a refuge for old hippies coming out of the counterculture of the 60s and 70s who fled San Francisco and Berkeley, and it has poets and artists and bohemian culture.
You tell, there's a story in the book that I thought really was a great little micro portrait of Napa. You talk about there's an annual wine auction there, and a recent wine auction, the mass stranger came in. Could you tell about that?
That's right. The Napa Valley Wine Auction every June is just the temple of conspicuous consumption, where wine connoisseurs from around the world fly in on their private planes, and they try to outdo each other with how much money they could spend for wine. And a few years ago, a mysterious man from Silicon Valley wearing all black showed up. No one knew who he was. He wasn't a player in the wine field, but he just showed up and spent $1.7 million on wine in a single day, including $500,000 for one bottle.
You said it worked out. It was a very big bottle, but it worked out to be $15,000 a glass.
A glass. That's right. You know, and it's very much not even about wine at that point. It's about showing off how much money you have and you can afford to spend. It becomes this public display of wealth that transcends connoisseurship.
Well, it makes for great tourism. But you focus a lot of your work on Sonoma and the changes that are taking place there. What is happening in Sonoma at this point?
Well, Sonoma used to be a place where people went to try to live the good life on the cheap. You would quit your job as a corporate executive and get an old barn in Sonoma and become an artist. But now Napa has become so extraordinarily exclusive that many new money techno moguls and people from Hollywood and Silicon Valley and New York feel shut out of Napa, that it's too hard and too expensive to build houses there, to build their trophy houses. And so instead they're going next door to Sonoma, and Sonoma is becoming more like Napa. It's becoming Hamptonized. And a lot of the poets and the painters are getting pushed out. But they're not going without a fight, and they've been putting up political battles to try to preserve the rural character and the small town culture and community that brought them there.
So like what? What's going on politically?
Well, there was a grassroots movement in Sonoma to have the voters go to the polls in November and vote to keep 80% of the land in Sonoma County rural for the next 30 years. So nothing the real estate developers could do could change that. But curiously, the voters in Sonoma didn't go for this measure. The newcomers idealized the beauty of the farm country, but a lot of the farmers didn't want to be stuck farming for the rest of their lives. They sort of secretly like the idea of being able to cash out and sell to developers.
Somehow that makes a certain level of sense.
It does. I mean, farming is a very hard thing to do.
Is wine the main source of income in the Sonoma Valley?
It is. And Sonoma is very conflicted because the people who live there want to keep their sense of being a small town in the middle of the country, but they're dependent on these foodie tourists going to the wineries, coming to the restaurants. Those outsiders are the people who support the small organic farmers who are growing salad greens for the restaurants that you read about in national magazines. So Sonoma has this kind of love-hate relationship with the wealthy outsiders who come there on their foodie pilgrimages, where Napa has sort of embraced that international image and has become a well-oiled machine for separating connoisseurs from large amounts of their money.
So what do you think is going to happen now?
Well, the economic downturn has helped Sonoma, has given it a little bit of a reprieve. But I think as the economy comes back and inevitably we have a new boom, that Sonoma will probably become more and more like Napa.
But you say that there is something that could change all this, as I remember.
There is. There is a tiny little insect called the glassy-winged sharpshooter, which has wiped out large areas of vineyards in Southern California. And there's a tremendous danger that if this little bug gets further north into Napa and Sonoma, that it very quickly could just wipe out the most prestigious vineyards in America and devastate the wine business, to the point that the land would only be good for housing subdivisions rather than being the rural paradise that it is now.
And so then everybody moves on to the next valley?
It's hard to tell what will happen. The glassy-winged sharpshooter can only survive in certain climates. So Washington State, Oregon are probably pretty safe from it, whereas Northern California is quite vulnerable.
Yeah, the French Laundry may be doing its wash in Portland.
That's right.
Hey, Alan, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Alan Deutschman writes for Fortune, Gentleman's Quarterly, and Vanity Fair. He's the author of A Tale of Two Valleys, Wine, Wealth, and the Battle for the Good Life in Napa and Sonoma. So you've learned to love your veggies. You're cutting back on meat. I mean, you are on top of things. Well, maybe not. Most of us do not have a clue about a whole realm of vegetables. They come from the sea. They're seaweed to you and me. Now, according to cookbook author and cooking teacher Jill Gussman, sea vegetables are incredibly nutritious and much of the world has been eating them forever. Well, her new book is Vegetables from the Sea, Everyday Cooking with Sea Greens. And you thought you were big time because you were eating kale. Hey, Jill, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Lynn, for having me.
So tell me about what we're talking about. I mean, are we talking seaweed here?
Well, you can either refer to these plants as either seaweed or you can call them sea vegetables. And I love to call them sea vegetables because these are amazing, edible, delicious, versatile plants that are vegetables that happen to grow from in the sea as opposed to vegetables that grow on land that we're most commonly familiar with.
Now, is this the kind of stuff I see washed up on the shore? Can I go and harvest?
Absolutely not the stuff you see on the beach at low tide.
Okay. All right.
Not that smelly stuff that's old and has been washed in and out of the sea multiple times. We're talking about vibrant, healthy plants that are harvested by hand and also by machinery that's pulled and cut at proper times and in the right season. Nothing on the beach ever, please.
Okay. So where do you get them?
Sea vegetables can be bought in most natural foods markets and some gourmet stores. And then in my book in the back, I list a number of mail order sources where you can buy beautiful quality sea vegetables that are harvested by hand by wild crafters here in the United States.
Now, is this something I have to buy dried and reconstitute? Or do I get
Yes.
them? I mean, are they like buying a head of lettuce?
No, most of the sea vegetables that are available to the public are in dried form, and you need to wash them and you need to rehydrate them prior to cooking.
What do they taste like?
There's a wide range of flavor. You can have a fairly sweet, mildly salty flavor sea vegetable, and then you can go into a more savory, slightly heartier flavor and texture, and then you can get into a very robust, earthy, salty flavor, a strong salty flavor.
You know, I'm remembering going to a great restaurant in San Diego where mm-hmm. I was served a seaweed salad, and it was three distinct piles of different colors. I think one was red, one was black, one was green. I'm sorry, there were four because I think one was very pale, and was stunning to me because each one had a completely different flavor, and I didn't sense they had been played with a lot. I realize this is like someone saying to you, you know, I once ate a green cookie. Can you give me the recipe? But, I mean, I was struck by how fresh these tasted. They tasted like green lettuce. So were they all reconstituted? And would you have any idea of what I was eating?
Most likely they were reconstituted. Most likely. It sounds like you had dulse, which would be the dark red kind of burgundy color.
Uh-huh.
Then the green one probably was a wakame. And you might have even had kombu mixed in there. And possibly for the lightest color one. Now you didn't tell me what color light, but I'm guessing that maybe it was a type of agar.
Yes.
Very mild.
Yeah. And it was, and every one of them was so delicious. I could have given up lettuce. Right at that moment.
There you go.
So, okay, now how do we work with them? Where would you want us to begin if we've never done anything like this?
If you've never used them at all or you're a little bit frightened of starting with them, I would do something that's very simple and easy, and that would be as simple as taking some sea vegetable out of the bag. In particular, sea palm is delicious, and you can just lightly rinse it with water. You can soak it for about 10, 15 minutes, and then you can actually drain that water and put a marination on it and let that rest for a couple of hours in the refrigerator. And then you can add that into other salads.
Ah, so do you actually cook some of these?
You can cook all of them, and you can also use most of them after you've washed them and reconstituted them. And preferably, I like to make them where they're slightly marinated, so you add some flavor, but you do that on the countertop or in the refrigerator. So it's very easy.
So I can take them and just throw them into stews or soups or things like that?
If you want to use some in soups or stews, you can simply rinse the sea vegetable off under running water and then just throw a piece into a pot and it'll soften and dissolve over time in about 15, 20 minutes for most of them.
Can you explain something? I think the sea vegetable we're most familiar with is what's wrapped around sushi. It's black.
Right. That's nori. And when you see the packages of nori in the stores or when you go and get sushi, that isn't a plant on its own that you see that's just been flattened out. That's actually plants that have been cooked into like a thick soup that's then spread out on drying sheets and then mechanically dried into these flat sheets. Very delicious.
So
that's one of the mildest sea vegetables there are.
Okay. Hey, Jill, thank you.
You're very welcome, Lynn.
Cooking teacher Jill Gussman's book, complete with source information, is Vegetables from the Sea. Now, a great way to start working with them is her recipe for sea palm Caesar salad. It's on the website, splendidtable.org.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? You should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have got Peter on the line. Peter, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is about grilling artichokes.
Uh-huh.
We had some really delicious grilled artichokes at a restaurant in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I think they used, the predominant flavor was Worcestershire sauce, as well as I could tell.
Uh-huh.
And I've tried a couple things out of grilling cookbooks where you use garlic and olive oil.
Right, right.
And they've come out really kind of greasy and not particularly good. Do you have any ideas?
Well, I think one of the keys would be, you said it, Worcestershire was the dominant taste.
It seemed, yeah.
Yeah. What, was there garlic in the backdrop? Was there?
I think so.
Okay. And you generally, what, you trim the artichoke, you have it?
Trim the artichoke, core out the purple part.
Right.
The spiky purple part.
Right.
This is after parboiling it.
Okay. Because if you try to grill it raw, it's going to take you 8 hours. You know, it just takes forever.
Right. So we parboil it. Cut the top off,
right.
Core it, and then trim the spiky leaves that are left with the scissors.
Uh-huh.
Cut it in half.
And then you put it on the grill.
And put it on the grill.
Okay.
And painted it with this oil with garlic in it.
You know what I'm wondering? I wonder if they marinated that parboiled artichoke in a mixture.
Oh.
Yeah, because think about this. You want to permeate that artichoke, and that artichoke's like a little sponge. If you do it, if you parboil it one day and do all the cunning, right?
Uh-huh.
And maybe, I'm just trying to think, okay, you have Worcestershire sauce. Let's just think this out. I wish we could get into that restaurant kitchen, but how about some Worcestershire sauce?
I wish I could remember the name.
You're in such good company about memory, trust me. You've got Worcestershire sauce. How about some Tabasco in there? Just
sure.
A little Tabasco, some fresh garlic, and maybe a hint of vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a cider vinegar. And if you insist, a little oil, but maybe we don't need any oil.
Yeah.
You know, we may not need it. And maybe a tad of brown sugar, but I mean a little bit.
Hmm.
And then mix that together first and give it a taste and see if it's reminiscent of what you were tasting in that artichoke.
Mm-hmm.
Before you do anything. And you can doctor that. You may want to add some mustard to it. You may want to add some ground onion to it. One of the ingredients, by the way, in Worcestershire sauce is tamarind, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Tamarind's very sour and fruity. So start with that combination, though. And then let it marinate. Brush it onto the artichoke, but let it sit overnight in the fridge. And then grill it, brushing it with more. And that little bit of sugar is also going to help it grill and crisp.
That really sounds great.
I have a feeling even if it's not exactly what you want, what you tasted, it's going to get you away from the olive oil, garlic, you know.
Yeah.
We all love the Mediterranean, but enough already.
Great.
Okay?
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. That is a great idea. You know, I meant what I said. We all love the Mediterranean, but I think sometimes I know I get stuck. And that idea of marinating vegetables in something like Worcestershire, Tabasco, a little brown sugar, maybe some vinegar and garlic, that could not hurt. And I think it just would be such a nice change. Can you imagine if you put onions and slices of sweet potato in that and then put them on a slow grill? That would have to just be killer. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this one goes back to our discussion about Napa and Sonoma. Remember the mention of that Center for Conspicuous Consumption, the annual Napa Valley wine auction? Now, this is where the wine crazies compete in spending money. Well, here's the trivia question. At the annual Napa Valley wine auction, what does your bidding number reveal? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. Thank you. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we'll be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, it went back to our discussion about Napa and Sonoma. Remember the mention of the annual Napa Valley wine auction where the wine crazies compete in spending money? Well, here was the trivia question. At that annual Napa Valley wine auction, what does your bidding number reveal? Your bidding number, which is on a paddle for all to see, reveals how much you spent at the auction last year. So if you have a bidding paddle number one, you were the biggest spender last year. If your number is two, you were the second biggest, and so on. Well, the story that our guest Alan Deutschman told was about the mysterious stranger dressed in black who strolled into the auction and outbid everyone. Now, what was stunning to the insiders at the auction was that his paddle number was 318. Immediately defining him in their world as a nobody. This upstart bought the most expensive bottle of wine ever auctioned. Now, granted, it was a big bottle. It was called an Imperial, which is equal to 8 normal bottles of wine. He paid $500,000 for the cult wine of cult wines, Screaming Eagle Cabernet. Now, this works out to a mere $15,000 a glass. And before he left the tent, he laid down $1.7 million. Okay, back to the real world and your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up next? We've got Judy calling. So, Judy, what is on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to ask a question about something I just discovered called jicama. And it's a root vegetable, I assume, of some sort from Mexico, but I want to know what to do with it because it has such a delicious flavor.
Oh, yeah. It's sweet and really crisp and crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of looks like a flattened, rounded sweet potato, right? It has a sort of a buff-colored skin on it, and it's mm-hmm. like a big, it looks like the shape of a big onion.
Right.
It's very popular in Mexico, but the other thing is, it is a great substitute for water chestnuts in any recipe that calls for them. It's a little sweeter than a water chestnut, but it has that wonderful crunch.
Mm.
Okay, you want to know what you can do with it, right?
Right.
Well, there's one great recipe that keeps coming to mind. I don't remember the exact ingredients, but you can play with this. You cut it into sticks, like the size of French fries,
mm-hmm.
and you dress it with a combination. This is from Rick Bayless, who's the great Mexican cook. You dress it with a combination of lime juice, fresh chilies, to your taste, obviously,
yes.
and chunks of tangerine and tangerine juice, salt and pepper, and then some fresh coriander leaves on that. Oh, the nice thing about it is make it early in the day, put it in the refrigerator and pull it out and you crunch on that cold. It is so good because the jicama tends to absorb those flavors.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is cut it in big dice and throw it into green salads.
Okay.
And then the other thing I've done with it is I've just taken the food processor. There's a julienne attachment you can use to make like matchsticks.
Right.
And I throw some lime juice and some a little bit of honey on it. And if I want it hot, I might throw Tabasco on it. I just let it sit in the fridge. It wilts just ever so slightly. And then I just keep that around to eat on sandwiches.
That sounds wonderful.
You know, like you have some cold leftover vegetables, or you have a salad that you want to turn into a sandwich, or you have some kind of meat or poultry. You just put that on the bread, and then you pile this on. And it's a wonderful, crunchy relish.
Oh, I'm so glad you could tell me all of this.
Hey, you're launched in jicama, woman. You are going to have such a good time.
Yes, I am, because I found a place where I can get it, and, I wanted to experiment and try some new things. So
go for it.
This is wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, you take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Ikama is dynamite because, you know, in the days when you used to be able to get fresh water chestnuts pretty easily, you didn't need Ikama. But canned water chestnuts are nothing like fresh. The fresh tend to be crunchy and sweet. So whenever a recipe calls for water chestnuts, try substituting Ikama. Okay, it's J-I-C-A-M-A. It's in the produce department, and you want it to be crisp and not have any mold or soft spots. And it keeps a couple of days in the fridge. 800-537-5252. Rachel's calling. Rachel, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about pita bread.
Okay.
I have tried several times using a recipe from Joy of Cooking to make pita bread at home.
Right.
And it makes a recipe of a total of 8 round breads. And consistently, only about half of them puff up and then, you know, deflate to create the pocket. And the other half just never puff up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm you know, using the same, it's from the same batch, and I'm using the same technique. So I'm wondering, what am I doing to one half that makes them puff up and not to the other half?
I think it's a matter of how thin you're rolling the dough. And you may not realize it, but you may not be rolling it as thin from one to another. By the way, if they don't puff up,
mm-hmm.
it's not the end of the world.
Well, you know, they still taste good.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Does the non-puffing happen more when you first start to bake than when you get toward the end of baking?
Yeah, generally.
Okay. You know what I wonder?
What's that?
Your oven may not be hot enough at that point.
It says it's preheated.
How long do you preheat usually?
Well, just until the thing beeps and says, okay, I'm at 450 now.
Okay, I've got an idea.
All right.
Take an oven thermometer.
Okay.
We can find them in hardware stores, kitchenware stores, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Stick it in the oven. And wait until it reads 450 and then do exactly the same recipe, and I'll bet you'll get more puffing. I'm just wondering if the oven's not quite hot enough, you have less chance of puff.
Ah, all right.
Yeah, but the other thing is, as long as they taste great,
mm-hmm.
you're in good shape, and know that many cooks go through the same thing.
Okay.
But try that oven thermometer, because sometimes the ding-ding goes off, and who knows, maybe the entire oven is not the right heat.
It dings in error.
Maybe so.
Okay. I will try it.
You take care.
Thanks so much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, we've got Jane calling. Jane, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I am looking for a sangria recipe. I went down to San Francisco a few weeks ago with a girlfriend on the hunt for some shoes for my wedding. And she took me to Cha-Cha-Cha on Haight Street, and we had wonderful sangria there. What I'm hoping to find is something that'll look good with my wine red shoes.
When are you getting married?
I'm in September, down at the beach.
And you want to match your shoes to the sangria? This is a great idea. I wish I had thought about that when I got married. Okay. All right. You know what sangria is, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's fruit that's lightly bruised and crushed with red wine and usually some seltzer water or mineral water, you know, bubbly water in there, too. I would say, now, traditionally, it's made with wines from the Valencia or Valdepeña area of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're red. And I think either one of those areas would give you more or less the color of your shoes. You can also use a Spanish wine called Tempranillo.
Okay.
Very inexpensive, by the way. But the idea is you want a full-bodied red wine, but not one that's very old, not one that's extremely fine. It should be drinkable. And then what you do, for every bottle of wine, you want about a cup of bubbly water that goes in at the last minute. You can do everything a day ahead on sangria, but the last minute you want some bubbles in it, you throw in the water.
Okay.
So you do sliced oranges and sliced limes and lemons, and I love peaches.
Oh.
What, you're getting married September. You should have good peaches, maybe, or nectarines.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, and you crush some of that, and then you just put everything in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
With big whole slices of the fruit as well, because it looks so great. And I'd say, quite frankly, this is what I would do. If it didn't match your shoes absolutely the way you wanted it, I'd use a drop or two of red food coloring.
I wouldn't go that far.
But you know what? The reason I say this, I can hear all our listeners now. They're hitting the floor. You know, they're in a state of shock. I'm going to get letters. But a long time ago, I worked with an artist who did food art. He mm-hmm. had been a student of Salvador Dali, need I say more. And he did these incredible, almost surrealistic dishes of food. And what I will never forget is his pasta sauce over pasta. He didn't toss it. He just had the white pasta and then this vivid red sauce. And I had never seen it. It was beautiful. And he was adding food coloring to it. I just figure it's your wedding. You know, if you really want to match it. So that's the idea. That's the idea. And I would say, look at the wine in the bottle. If the wine looks like it's right for the shoes and it's drinkable, that's what I would use.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We receive all challenges. We take anything on here. You want to match something? We'll come up with a dress. We'll come up with an outfit. We'll come up with an accessory. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We've got Carol calling. Carol, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I grew up in Louisiana and love fresh seafood, especially fresh fish.
Right.
And I'm now living in Oklahoma, a landlocked state. So I have to rely on finding fish in most supermarkets. And I really don't know how to tell whether the fish that I'm looking at is fresh or whether I should buy it or not or pass on it. And also, is there a way that you can tell whether fish has been previously frozen and then thawed?
Well, let's answer the last question first. Most reliable and reputable stores will actually say previously frozen on the package. If the fish has the head on, if the eye is clear and bulging, in so many words, if it looks like it hasn't been sitting around for a while, the fish is fresh. The other thing is, if it's a whole fish, ask if you can poke it gently. Don't be afraid to do this, because if the impression of your finger stays in the flesh, the fish is not in good condition. If it just gently springs back, you know, if it's resilient, you're dealing with a fresh fish. If you're looking at a fillet, okay, it should look firm. It shouldn't have sections of it kind of separating. You've probably seen this, where you'll see the fillet is sitting there, and there's starting to be crevices in it. That's a sign that it's deteriorating. It should be firm in appearance. It should be intact in appearance. And when you smell it, there should be no unpleasant fishy smell. And when you poke it gently, it should be resilient. So those are the basic clues to look for.
Okay.
So does that give you some of the guidelines? Is this helping?
Well, I certainly hope so. The idea of being able to poke the fish, or even having the lady behind the counter poke the fish, would help me.
I'd say ask if you can please, A, you can smell it, and B, if you could poke it, because often they can just take it out and hold it out for you.
Because most of the fish we see are filleted already.
Yeah, exactly. You very seldom these days see a fish with its head on. If you can see any of the skin of the fish, it should have a healthy gleam to it. It shouldn't look shriveled or dried out in any way.
Okay, well, I appreciate your information. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Goodbye. I can just see moving from New Orleans to Oklahoma City when you are lover of fish. Maybe you have to go through an adjustment. You can call us, 800-537-5252. Well, you know, olive oil isn't the only oil coming out of the Mediterranean. I've been hearing about something called argan oil. Now, one importer is Mustafa's Fine Foods of Morocco. They're based in Seattle. And we have its CEO on the phone, Mustafa Hadouch. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Mustafa?
Oh, you're pronouncing it perfectly.
Well, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Could you explain to us what argan oil actually is?
Argan oil is a nut oil. It's been around in Morocco for, it's from the tertiary period, which was like 25 million years ago.
Huh.
It grows mainly in southwestern Morocco. There are other countries that are trying to grow it, like Mexico, they tried in China, Israel, but I don't think it has given fruit. And it takes 50 to 60, 70 years to, you know, bear fruit.
So you would have to plant this for your children and your grandchildren.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing.
Now, I had read that it takes 20 hours to produce 1 quart of argan oil?
Yes, it's very labor intensive, and it's very hard. The tree is very thorny, so the only way to collect the argan nuts are to just let them drop to the ground. Well, usually they used to have goats eat them and then collect after that.
Oh.
But that's the old traditional way.
I see. Yeah. But not the way your oil is made, right?
No. That's, okay. Now what they do, by the way, there were women's co-ops that were set up by a woman professor of chemistry at the university in Rabat to organize the whole argan production and to keep that whole culture going.
Huh.
And so the way they do it, they let the nut drop in the fall. Then it's collected. They remove there's a thin layer. It's like almost like a fruit. It's almost like looks like a fig, like a dried fig. So there is that's removed, and then has two shells. So those have to be cracked by hand.
Oh my.
And inside the shells are like it's like an almond, but sometimes there is like 2 or 3 nuts in there.
Uh-huh.
And it's very bitter, but it makes a wonderful oil.
What does it taste like?
Well, it's like a hazelnut oil.
Ah, because I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to throw my 2 cents in here because I've had one sip. It is like eating warm nuts. It's so toasty.
Yeah, it is very nice. And it's beautiful. It works beautifully as a vinaigrette. It works beautifully with mushrooms, white meats. It's a nice drizzling oil.
Mm-hmm. I kept thinking that if you sweetened this very lightly and sprinkled it over vanilla ice cream with crushed almonds, because it has such a nutty flavor.
Yeah, and actually it works beautifully with chocolate.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. What does it sell for?
It's very expensive. And the bottle goes from $20 for the 10 centiliter bottle, 100 milliliter, to $40.
How many ounces is that?
That's like 4 ounces.
4 ounces
for $20.
For $20.
Uh-huh.
Well, when you hear how it's made, and you've eliminated the goats from the process, I can understand, you know, this gets to be expensive.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mustafa Hadouche is CEO of Hadouche Gourmet Imports in Seattle. Now, you can get information on argan oil on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. Just dial up 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this bit of silliness in honor of the season. How do you fix a broken tomato? With tomato paste, of course. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. You know, you can find everything you heard here today, and even things you didn't hear today, on our website, splendidtable.org. You can also find our free newsletter. Now, it's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.